People are often really surprised that someone could go into programming or software engineering having been an opera singer. I also had a lot of advantages, which is that... Hi everyone, my name's Anna McDougall. I have successfully changed careers twice, once into opera singing and then from opera into tech as a software engineer.
So the question is, when do you know that you're ready for this change? How do you know?
Ooh, that's a hard question. I think you know when you're not in the right place. And there kind of came a moment where I had to make a decision.
One societal perception that will make the life of people who change jobs easier. What would that be?
Ooh, good question. Maybe I think it would be the idea that...
So what other thing people who want to work in tech should know and should prepare for?
Yeah, it's a team sport. It kind of doesn't matter how good you are as an individual if you're incapable of firstly communicating about code, being able to explain what you're doing to other people, but also be able to work with other people. You don't have to be a leader, you don't have to be like a manager type of personality, but you do need to be able to at least...
What are other misconceptions about the tech industry that people have in their minds, but they're not right?
I've seen so many engineers not get promotions or even not get hired, you know, because they don't have the ability to actually...
Hi, Anna. I'm so excited to have you on my podcast. Really excited.
Hi. Welcome. Yes, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you. Really pumped.
Let's start with you telling us something about your childhood, your upbringing, and everything that really influenced you to become the person you are today.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I think I've always, like my whole life, I've been someone who's got lots of different interests. And that was true as a child. It's still true today. But it's part of kind of why my journey has been so, I suppose, interesting. As a kid, I was very interested in theater. I was very interested in computers. So at the age of 8, I picked up a book which was called How to Learn HTML at Home. This was in like 1995 when like barely anyone had the internet at home anyway. But yeah, I started learning to make websites at that age and studied, did some computer studies at school. At the same time, I was also doing singing lessons. I was studying languages, I was doing theater. So really, I always had this huge, broad range of interests growing up. And they all, I think, contributed in the end to my kind of weird and wonderful story.
Great. Absolutely. I also like a lot of different things. And when you look at my career, it's very, very squiggly, just like yours.
Yes, you know, yes, squiggly lines.
And on the surface of it, they're not connected at all, right? But... Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you build an interesting life out of it, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
You mentioned already and that you navigated several career changes. So the question is, when do you know that you're ready for this change? How do you know?
Ooh, that's a hard question. it's an important question, though. I think you know when you're not in the right place. And I think for me, that was the feeling I had both times that I did it. The first time I had built a career of only about 3 years out of university, working in digital communications, working in marketing. And I kind of had the feeling I really loved the business world. I still kind of do. Like, I'm a very ambitious person. But I knew I had this kind of theatrical side, let's say, that wasn't being expressed. And I decided to take singing lessons just as like an expression of that, like as a hobby, really. But in the process of doing that, my singing teacher, who was herself an operatic soprano, kind of said to me, you know what, I think you could actually do this as a career. So I guess it was a combination of her kind of giving me that push and saying like, yes, you could do this, like not just as a hobby, and me also, I guess, looking for that creative outlet, looking to have this adventure I had always wanted to study opera. I was particularly attracted to the fact that it allowed me to not just sing, but also be on stage and also learn languages. So that was something that kind of appealed to that multifaceted personality that I mentioned earlier. And so I guess it was a combination of that, like wanting that, and then also having someone really believe in me and lift me up and give me that push that I needed to get started. Yeah.
So that was the first thing, the first time.
Yeah.
When you became an opera singer out of the blue,
yes.
Right? And what about the second time?
Yeah, so the second time I had been singing then for about 7 years. So I had completed my master's. I had been doing work for Opera Australia. I was playing the role of Cinderella in schools in New South Wales. That's where Sydney is. And I had moved to Germany to kind of look for work in the theatre system here, and very successfully, actually, I found a position at Hessen State Theatre. I was singing in the chorus there. I was singing some small solo parts. In the summers, I was traveling overseas and doing solo performances in Prague, in the United States, all over the world. And it was very successful. But then again, there kind of came a moment where I had to make a decision. And that moment in this case was the birth of my first child. So I was pregnant with my first child, and I really had this moment where I had to think, okay, after she is born and I've got this 1 year of leave, which is very a lovely luxury that we have here in Germany, do I want to go back to music? Right? Because I had to move cities as part of that. Yeah. And I wouldn't be able to just walk back into my old job. I would have to look for a new job. That meant more auditions. That means a lot of travel. Singing as an industry means singing at night, singing on weekends, singing on holidays, Christmas, New Year's, Easter, all of these have a lot of concerts often involved with them. So I knew that if I continued that, it would be a lifestyle that would be quite hard to do with a kid. Especially, I should add, as an Australian, with an Australian, we have no family here to support us. So it's not the kind of thing where I can just call up grandma and and get some help. So it was a situation where I thought, okay, am I really so in love with my work? Like, is this really what I need to do, what I want to do so much that it's worth all of those sacrifices? Because for some people it is, right? Even though it's very hard, that's who they are. That's all they can imagine doing. But that wasn't the case for me. And I knew, as said, I had this business brain, I had this ambitious side to me. And as much as being a singer is a very difficult thing to do and does take a lot of hard work and ambition, I really wanted to feel more in charge of my own career and to have more sense of direction. Because once you're a singer, right? There's no like senior singer or singer manager, you know, it's like it doesn't exist. So for me, it was a situation where I was like, okay, I've got this ambition, I've got this side of me. What else can I do with this like business, logical, analytical brain, this ambitious desire? And as you kind of rightly foreshadowed, I started thinking back on like, okay, what did I like as a kid? Like what did I like to do? What else am I passionate about? I thought about languages. I thought about potentially speech pathology, given that I had worked with the voice a lot, that could be a good transition point. But in the end, I saw that there was demand for software engineers. I remembered doing this coding as a kid and loving it. And so I thought, okay, well, why don't I just try it? I've got this maternity leave time. This was during the corona lockdown. So my husband, who is also a singer, wasn't working. So he was at home. So I had more support with the baby. And I actually could play around with code and kind of get back into that world. And when I did that, it was like a light bulb went off. And suddenly I was like, oh, wow, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
What is the common thing between programming and opera singing?
Yeah, I get asked this quite a lot. People are often really surprised that someone could go into programming or software engineering having been an opera singer, and they say, wow, those are completely different. in many ways they are. Yes, I understand that the output is very different. I will say that in many ways the process is actually very similar, if you want the creative process or the problem-solving process. A lot of different crafts, and for this I include everything from like carpentry to music, involve similar processes. And that is, you have a set of tools and a set of systems that you have to learn how to use. In the case of opera, you know, you need to learn how to read music, you need to learn how to pronounce different languages. And in terms of the tools, you know, you need to learn how to use your voice and your body to support that sound, because in opera there are no microphones, so you have to project your voice over an orchestra with no technological assistance. So that itself is like a challenge. That's a tool that you have to learn how to create and use. And then you try to solve a problem. And the problem is the score or the piece of music, and you want to impress the audience. That could be making them laugh, cry, whatever. You want them to feel something. You want them to be in the story. You want them to have a certain experience. And the only way you can do that is by knowing all of those tools and systems and languages, and then putting them together in the right way to create the right effect. And if you think that sounds like programming, you're absolutely correct. So it's exactly the same thing, right? You know, you need to learn tools, you need to learn systems, you need to learn languages, programming languages, and you need to be able to put those together in a certain way to give the user a certain effect. Of course, as I said, the output is very different, but the actual process, yeah, having to learn those things is very similar. So in that sense, I felt like I had a real advantage coming into tech, because I had already kind of gone through this experience of not knowing how any of those things worked. Yeah, I came into music as a non-musician, right? I didn't know key signatures. I didn't know the circle of fifths. I didn't know any music theory. And that was a huge transition, a very difficult transition to make. So I'd kind of done that before. And then coming into tech, it was like, oh yeah, I know this. Like, I just have to be a bit clueless for quite a while. And if I keep plugging away at it and I keep learning and I just be regimented about it, I know I'll learn it because I've done this before with opera. Yeah. So I kind of had this huge advantage to my mind, in that I wasn't intimidated by how little I knew. I was kind of just like, oh yeah, that's part of the process. So there is actually a surprising amount of crossover, it's definitely not what people traditionally think of when they think of training to become a software engineer, that's for sure.
No, absolutely. And when you explained it, the way you explained it, it just makes sense. Absolutely. Languages, etc. is the process to get there, to effect a change is one and the same, mm-hmm. right? But it's completely yes. different industries, and that's why everybody is puzzled. But on top of that, during that transition, in your book, you're writing, I was a 32-year-old mom with an extremely varied work background, living in a country where I was not totally fluent in the language. So there are a lot of, I don't want to call disadvantages, but obstacles.
Sure.
And yet you continued on this path. So what gave you the strength?
Yeah, like I said, I feel like it was having done it before with opera, with music. I think that gave me a lot of resilience, and that meant that when I was faced with this obstacle, I knew that I just had to keep going. You know, there's this thing called the Dunning-Kruger effect, you know, where you first start learning something and you feel like, oh, this is super easy. Like, why doesn't everyone do this? But as you keep going, you suddenly realize you fall into this like slump where you realize, oh, actually, hang on, this field is way bigger than I thought. So for me, I think I had an advantage because I always assumed that I was down in that pit. So that meant I knew, okay, I just have to keep going, just like I did with opera, and it will happen. I guess the other thing was the fact that it did click with my brain. So actually, I would say with programming, it happened a lot easier for me than it did for music. I still to this day don't really consider myself a musician in the sense that I'm not highly theoretical. I don't really understand the deep technical, so to speak, background of what I'm doing. I'm a good performer. I'm a good singer. I can do that part of the job really well. But when it comes to actually understanding the deeper side of it, I was never really there. That was never really me. But with tech, it was actually completely different. So with tech, it was like everything came easily. Everything I just understood straight away. You know, I might have to do a little bit more research here and there to get clarification on things, but that's totally normal. And so I think there was also that that kept me going, because I was like, oh, this, I know I should be doing this. And furthermore, I think I also was aware that despite having some, let's say, disadvantages in terms of definitely not being what German recruiters are looking for when they're looking for a software engineer, they are not thinking of someone who was like me. On the other hand, I also had a lot of advantages, which is that I had worked in team leadership before. So I knew how to work with people. I'd been in a corporate environment before. I know how business works. Yeah, I have a business brain. And I also am very good at communicating and good at talking with people. And that is actually a huge part of software engineering. People don't think of it. When they think of the stereotype, you know, they see like usually a teenage boy in a dark yeah. room in the basement, you know, all by himself. But the reality is it's actually a super social job, you know, maybe not as much as recruiting or something like that, but certainly you have to be communicating with a team. You have to be strategizing together. You have to be understanding what other people in the team are doing at any one stage in order to be successfully collaborating. So I kind of came in with some big advantages as well, and I didn't want to sell myself short. I was very aware of the advantages I had. But I guess with the disadvantages, to go back to your question, there was definitely a question of, will I be accepted? Will I belong? And part of the reason you mentioned my book, part of the reason I called it You Belong in Tech is because that's exactly what I needed to hear when I got started. So I thought, okay, I'll call my book that because someone out there needs to hear it. That like, yes, it doesn't matter like who you are, like you can have a career here if you dedicate yourself to making that change. So that was really, yeah, how I got to that point, I suppose.
So in your book also, you're mentioning that you found a job in tech partly through Twitter. So can you give us a little bit more on this?
As said, I had some advantages.
Yeah, if the story was not interesting now it's Twitter get involved.
Yes, this was pre-Elon Musk for the record. So when I started coding, I quickly discovered there's this very popular hashtag in the coding community called 100 Days of Code. The idea being that you do a little bit of coding every day and then you tweet about what you're doing every day. So it's like a little mini journal, right, of your progress. So I decided to do that, and that kind of got me into tech Twitter. I'd been on Twitter before for a few other things. I used to stream video games and stuff like that as a hobby. And so I'd been on Twitter before, but this was kind of like a little challenge. I thought, okay. But through doing that, I started finding other newbie coders. I found other like tech influencers. I started like really seeing what was happening in the tech scene. And I started being more proactive about tweeting more about what I was doing, not just little updates, but actually saying, okay, this is what I'm learning. This is what I've learned. This is what you can take away from it, or here's my progress on that. And then just basically keeping people in the loop about what I was doing and encouraging others to keep going, talking about blogging, because I had this marketing experience. I was also starting to blog a lot about technical topics and helping other people learn to do technical blogging. Because as I said, I had an advantage that I kind of had this other background. I started creating videos on YouTube as well. You can still see them. It's a very, very inactive YouTube channel, but they're all still there. About JavaScript concepts and like just teaching basic programming. And then when New Year's rolled around, I had been in a training program. I was in a training program at the time. And I posted something like, oh, I'm so excited. This is the year I get my first tech job. You know, I was thinking like May or June, maybe July this year, which was when my course officially finished. But through that tweet, people actually messaged me and said, like, oh, if you're looking for work, like, you should apply to us. Like, you know, here's our company. Do you want to have a chat to this person? And as I started doing that, so I was just like, okay, yeah, sure, why not? Like, I'm a believer in saying yes. So I said, okay, yeah, let's try it. I was not prepared for the job search at that time. So I had to like quickly put together a portfolio, quickly put together a CV. Like I didn't have any of that stuff ready yet. And in doing that, I also recorded a little like video introduction to myself where I said like, you know, I'm Anna McDougall. I have 6 years of experience in digital marketing and communications. You know, talked a bit about my tech stack, about my right to work in Germany because I was looking for a job here in Germany. All that kind of stuff. Basically, the things that most people would ask in a screening interview, I kind of put into like a little 2-minute video. And I posted that on Twitter saying, hey, everyone, I'm looking for work. This is more about me. If you know anyone who's hiring in Germany, let me know. And it just went off. Like everyone, because I'd built up this Twitter following, I think I had about 20 to 25,000 followers. Oh. People just were like, yeah, let's help Anna. Like I'd never asked for anything from them before. And so suddenly they were like retweeting, encouraging their friends to also retweet and all that stuff. And I got about a dozen leads within 24 hours from that tweet. And one of those leads was for a company called Novatech, which is this great software consultancy over in Stuttgart. And they basically ended up hiring me as a junior software engineer. So it was a very fast, wild, cool process, but it really almost happened by accident in the end. But yeah, so that's kind of, again, how my marketing background, I guess, in a way, it got me the job because I had those skills being on camera, but also writing, creating content, being proactive on Twitter meant that I'd created those connections and created a reputation for myself as well.
Great. So that's the power of social network.
Yeah.
It's amazing. That's a great story. You were talking about the importance of other qualities, not only coding, and technical skills, but also communication, etc. You know, building your brand. So what other things people should know, people who want to work in tech should know and should prepare for?
Yeah, it's a team sport. I think that's the main thing I want to get across. Like, if you want to go back to the opera analogy, you know, there are soloists and there are choristers. But even the soloists on stage, they still need to be coordinated with an orchestra, with a conductor. They need to be standing in the right place at the right time so that other people can get their cues and do what they need to do on stage. So even if you are a strong technical performer, even if you are, as they call it, a 10x developer, you know, someone who is just has an amazing technical mind, it kind of doesn't matter how good you are as an individual if you're incapable of firstly communicating about code, yeah, being able to explain what you're doing to other people, but also be able to work with other people. You don't have to be a leader, you don't have to be like a manager type of personality, but you do need to be able to at least coordinate with other people, be on the same page as them, be willing to take feedback. Yeah, that's a huge one. With code, like with any type of writing, right? You make mistakes, you don't do things quite the right way, or you overlook something, and it can happen to anyone, everyone. Every single piece of code is reviewed, and you have to be able to take that feedback when someone comes to you and says, why are you doing it this way? Why didn't you do it that way? This part here has a typo in it. This part here actually doesn't conform with our testing requirements or whatever it is. You need to be able to take that and be like, oh yeah, whoops, my bad. Like I'll just fix that up. You know, not like how dare you? So that ability to take feedback in a positive way is definitely a skill that needs to be there if you're going to have a successful career. And yeah, just the ability to communicate about code. I can't say that enough. If you can explain technical concepts to non-technical people, yeah, you are already way ahead of the pack. That is a huge, huge advantage in tech, because the majority of the people who are making the product decisions around tech are not engineers. Like the CEOs, the product owners, the clients, if you're working for a consultancy, they usually don't know how software works. They know what they want at the end, and they know maybe the feeling they want at the end, but they can't express that in technical terms. So if they want something that you can't do technically, or that has to be done in a complex way technically, you need to have the ability to explain that in simple language that they will actually understand. Because some things that seem easy are actually hard to do, and some things that seem hard are actually easy to do. And they can only know that if you can communicate about it. So yeah, those would be the two big ones, the ability to take feedback and the ability to communicate about code.
Absolutely. And the ability to communicate with simple terms, that's so important because...
Yeah.
Because we are not, we are users, right? I have no clue about the technical terms. And when somebody starts speaking to me with, in some slang, they lose me. They lose me and that's it. I move to the other person or to the other project or to the other platform or whatever.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Exactly.
What are other misconceptions about the tech industry that people have in their minds, but they're not right?
Yeah, I think definitely it's this old school stereotype from the movies, right? Like there really is this idea that most software engineers are like young men geeks sitting in their basement. And like certainly that can happen. It's not like it doesn't exist. But I mean, we have people now who have been coding for 30 years, you know, they're in their 50s, they're in their 60s, you know, more. We have people who are, of course, men, women, non-binary, transgender. Like we have people of all different shapes and colors and heights and religions and nationalities, all who are producing code. So again, I think this idea that, oh, if I'm a certain age or a certain gender or a certain look or certain style, like, oh, they won't accept me or I can't code. It's just not true. Of course, there are some problems with culture in tech, as with any male-dominated industry or any single gender-dominated industry. There is always going to be, I suppose, some prejudices that exist. So for example, a lot of women engineers who I meet who are very what we call femme, so you know, they like to do their hair and makeup and wear really nice clothes, they often feel out of place or stereotyped because they're not like wearing dirty hoodies and jeans. You know, it's just a very different look. It's a very different style. And it's one that a lot of people aren't used to yet. But I will say that's only because it hasn't kind of filtered through to everywhere yet. It's not that they don't exist. Like, so we're out there. So no matter what type of person you are, there is a place for you. That would be my main message. And you are welcome. You just have to find that place and find your people. Yeah. And online communities are great for that because like you can find communities for any type of programmer really that exists. And that can give you that kind of extra support if you feel you need it and you're not getting it. So that would be one. I'm trying to think. I suppose, yeah, again, this idea that technical people aren't social or aren't sociable, I think it's just, that's again, just changing over time. And hopefully as tech is now such a team sport, it's just a normal part. I've seen so many engineers not get promotions or even not get hired, you know, because they don't have the ability to actually express what they're doing. So as said, the stereotype that communication doesn't matter, or that like, oh, it only matters if you're like this elite hacker, you know, that's definitely not true.
You had a TED talk and you were talking about the benefit and the value of career changer. So
yeah.
So how to find this value and how to present it?
Career changer. Exactly. Yeah. It was called Finding and Proving Your Value as a Career Changer. So I think I don't want to give the whole talk again, but I'll try to summarize it. I think there were two major things that I said to focus on. I think the first is the balance between humility and confidence. So as a career changer, you have to be humble enough to know that you're coming from behind, right? That you don't have the same background as most people who are coming into that industry, and that puts you at a disadvantage. And so you have to be humble enough to learn from those people, right? In my first job as a junior software engineer, I was in a group with, or in a team with, I think three guys who had all just come straight out of university. So they were all like young German men in their early 20s, you know, like really the stereotype. And I knew, okay, in many ways they have an advantage because I don't have a computer science degree. And so I used the opportunity to learn from them. You know, I asked them about what they were learning. I asked them how they were approaching things. I really had to stay humble enough to understand what they knew and what value I could learn from them, at the same time being very confident in my own abilities to communicate and to use my knowledge. There are some things that I learned through my certification that they had not learned in their computer science degree. So I was also teaching them some things. So there was kind of like we were helping each other, but that only came through that combination of being humble enough to take criticism and to see the gaps in my knowledge and to welcome those gaps in my knowledge as a learning opportunity, while at the same time being very confident in what I brought to the table that was different. And so that's, I think, in terms of like finding your value, that's part of where it is. It's being able to say, okay, what do I have that a traditional candidate does not have that brings value? Yeah, and if you can kind of answer that question, you have kind of like the centerpiece of your job application, really. That needs to be where it comes from. So that's the finding side. When we talk about the proving side, yeah, then I have a system that I coin in my book, but it's called the NNQ system, which means names, numbers, and quotes. And the idea there is that when you're applying, it's good to use names of people in the company who you already know. That comes from networking, that comes through just casual coffee chats. Maybe you're reaching out to someone to ask a question before you even apply for a job to get an idea of what that would actually entail before you apply for it. That's names. There's numbers. Yeah, numbers being how you prove what you've done. Yeah, you use numbers as much as you can. And the example I gave in the TED talk was like, if I say, okay, as an opera singer, I performed in many different languages on stages all over the world with lots of people on stage at the same time. Okay, well, cool. But what if I say I've performed in three different continents across seven different languages, sometimes with up to 120 people on stage at the same time, right? It hits harder, right?
Yeah, yeah, big difference.
I'm saying the same thing, but it feels provable, right? Yeah, it's something concrete that people can hold on to. So that's numbers. And the very last one is quotes. There is, you know, human beings, we love stories. We trust recommendations from our friends more than we trust recommendations from like online ads, for example. And it's the same here. You know, if you can get even just small quotes from people you've worked with that are saying how good it is to work with you and how effective you are, those can go a long way. So one of the things I did on my CV when I applied for my current position is I actually had a page of quotes after the CV, two-page CV, and then after that I had a page of quotes from people I had worked with, yeah, and most of these quotes were about 3 to 4 sentences long, talking about why it was good to work with me.
That's a great idea. Great idea.
Yeah, it's kind of like using the recommendations section on LinkedIn. That's another way to do it. Yeah, is really like contact coworkers, former bosses, former employees if you're in a management position, and just have them write a few sentences about why it's good to work with you. And then you've kind of got that those quotes to back you up. So yeah, if you've got names of people inside the company, so for example, I could say, oh, I met Alice at an event last week. I think she's in your software engineering department. She said great things about the culture you have over there at Company Incorporated. I want to apply to this position because that aligns strongly with my values. I'm coming from a company where I've been responsible for 30 engineers across four different projects, and I'm now looking for a new challenge. My employee, John, described me as someone with great energy who makes every meeting fun, and I'd love to be able to do that for your company.
Wow.
There's your pitch. It. Yeah.
It's all packed.
Yeah.
So I don't need to.
Yeah, names, numbers, quotes.
Very good. No, that's really great. If you have to change, if you have the power to change one societal perception that will make the life of people who change jobs easier, what would that be?
Ooh, good question. Maybe I think it would be the idea that, so this is a thing in Germany, definitely, that like if you change jobs, that somehow means that you are not committed or you're lacking direction or something along those lines. I think it's just not realistic personally. You know, I think that the fact is people change over time and you can be entirely committed and loyal and dedicated to the work that you're doing. But if 5 or 10 years later, you find that you're a different person and your priorities have changed, that job might no longer be right for you, or that company might not no longer be right for you, or that country might no longer be right for you. You know, you never know what it is. But the fact is that I think if we were to underestimate career changes as people who are just like floating around, I think that's not giving them the credit that they deserve. Because a lot of the time, career changes are actually super pragmatic people. They know that something has to change and they are proactively looking for a way to change it. And if and when they successfully do that, that actually shows a lot of guts. It shows a lot of resilience and it shows that you have the kind of mind that can take on multiple challenges and multiple problems that maybe someone who is more settled in their job for their whole life might not ever face. So I think it's something where I have a huge respect for career changes of all stripes, because I think they show courage and they show resilience. And I think it's, so if I could change one thing, you know, change one perception, it would be this idea of, oh, okay, if you're a career changer, then like, you just don't know what you want. Like you just, that's all it is. Like, and it's like, well, no, in fact, if anything, they know what they want and they're working really hard to get it in a way, because they're making up for lost time. You know, they've got a big challenge ahead of them to do that. You know, if I had known when I was 17, graduating high school, that I would end up in tech, I could have saved myself a lot of time and effort, yeah, exactly. Right? But I also wouldn't be as effective as I am today. I wouldn't be as resilient as I am today. And I think that in many ways, having that background as a career changer makes me far more valuable in my current role than if I had followed a traditional path, for me personally. So I feel very lucky in some respects, even though it was a really hard way to get in, that I feel lucky that I had that journey.
What a great way to end the podcast. Thank you so much. Very inspirational, great ideas you gave here that even I'm going to use. I mean, that thing about NNQ is really, really great.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. And thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Anna.